Hello, this is your Some Signs of Arizona volunteer leader, Joanna Rowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, January 13th, 2026. And here are today's news briefs. Canada's Carney to visit China amid tension with U.S. The Prime Minister's visit this week comes amid the hostile relations U.S. President Donald Trump has launched in the Western Hemisphere, including with close neighbors Canada and Mexico, since returning to the White House a year ago. Canadian officials see the visit as part of an effort to recalibrate relations with China after a decade of tensions, while Mr. Carney describes it as a part of an economic vision that aims to move Canada's economy from reliance to resilience. Beijing is calling the three-day visit an opportunity for Canada to embark on a new strategic autonomy. Staff, January 13, 2026. Marine Le Pen appeared in Paris court. The French far-right politician's month-long appeals trial opens today. Ms. Le Pen was convicted last March of embezzling European Union funds, where she was sentenced to 4 years in prison and barred from running for office for 5 years. The National Valley Party frontwoman has said she will give up her 2027 presidential bid if convicted. She has suggested that current party president Jordan Bardella could run in her stead. Staff, January 13, 2026. Vance to host meeting on Greenland in Washington. The meeting will be between the vice president and his Greenlandic counterpart this week. Denmark's foreign minister says the vast Arctic island is a semi-autonomous territory of Denmark, a NATO ally of the United States. President Trump reiterated his argument that the U.S. needs to take Greenland, otherwise Russia or China would, in comments aboard Air Force One on Sunday. He said he'd rather make a deal for the territory, but one way or the other, we're going to have it. A bipartisan U.S. congressional delegation is headed to Copenhagen for meetings on Friday and Saturday in an attempt to show unity between the U.S. and Denmark. Associated Press, January 13, 2026. Trump filed 25% tariff on nations doing business with Iran. Iran said it was keeping communication with Washington open as President Trump considered how to respond to the Islamic Republic's crackdown on nationwide protests. The government has eased restrictions on international phone calls, but the internet remains blocked, and hundreds of people have reportedly been killed. Scott Peterson reports on why the sweeping demonstrations have grown into an existential threat for the regime. Staff, January 13, 2026. U.S. disguised plane used in boat strikes as civilian. The first strike on an alleged drug smuggling vessel in September was conducted using an aircraft made to look like a civilian plane, officials told the New York Times. The acknowledgement has prompted new legal concerns about recent operations, with some experts calling the strategy perfidy, a war crime. A White House spokesperson claimed the attacks are in line with the law of armed conflict. Staff, January 13, 2026. Senator Mark Kelly sued Secretary Hegseth. The retired Navy captain says the Pentagon violated his right to free speech by censuring and moving to demote him after he encouraged troops to disobey illegal orders. On January 15th, Secretary Hegseth issued a letter of censure saying Mr. Kelly's conduct undermines the chain of command and counsels disobedience. Arizona Democrats' lawsuit argues the department's actions amounted to retaliation. Staff, January 13, 2026. Japan cozying up to South Korea amid pressure from China. Japanese Prime Minister Sumimi Takitachi opened a summit with South Korean President Lee Jong-un to push forward trade and security ties and build trust. Facing challenges from China and North Korea, the two U.S. allies have overcome historical friction to step up defense cooperation in recent years. Beijing is reportedly restricting rare earth exports to Japan as part of a campaign to punish Ms. Takachi for her supportive stance towards Taiwan, the democratic island claimed by Beijing. Staff, January 13, 2026. ICC opened landmark case on Rohingya. The International Criminal Court will consider the persecution of Myanmar's Rohingya minority, marking a step towards justice for hundreds of thousands of refugees. It's been more than 6 years since the Gambia filed the case accusing Myanmar's military of genocide, and more than a decade since a genocide case has reached this level in the United Nations top court. The outcome could set important precedents for how the world handles such allegations moving forward. Staff, January 12, 2026. Our first article is on the economy. Powell pushes back on Fed probe as Trump denies intimidation charge. By Laurent Belsey, staff writer, and Henry Gass, staff writer. January 13, 2026. A year-long tug-of-war over interest rate policy between the White House and the Federal Reserve has broken out into the open, with political and economic implications that are just beginning to play out. On Sunday evening, Fed Chair Jerome Powell posted a video on social media saying what many in political and economic circles had already assumed. Mr. Powell said that the Justice Department had threatened criminal charges over statements he made to Congress about office renovation costs as a pretext to pressure him to lower interest rates. By going public, however, Mr. Powell has created the most public confrontation between a president and a Fed chair in at least 75 years. There's nothing like this in recent Fed history, says Michael Barlow, an economic historian emeritus at Redcruz in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Presidents have, in some way or other, tried to push the Fed to lower rates, but none were as obvious and direct and threatening as this president, where the administration used the legal system to go after somebody. The latest confrontation raises the stakes for both President Donald Trump and Mr. Powell. Politically, the charge in Mr. Powell's post puts President Trump on the hot seat. By publicly making the Fed's independence the central issue, Mr. Powell is highlighting a principle widely supported in business, market, and even political circles. Independent central banks might make better decisions than politically dominated ones. The question is whether Mr. Trump will buck that principle or back off from what many observers see as a coercion campaign. Legally, the outcome remains to be seen. Will the Department of Justice secure a grand jury indictment against Mr. Powell? If it does, will it overcome the steep challenge of winning in court? Will it be influenced by a U.S. Supreme Court case being argued later this month about the president's effort to fire another Fed governor, Lisa Cook? Economically, the record strongly supports the idea that central banks should remain independent. When central bankers set rates, Inflation tends to stay in check and economies prosper. When political leaders are in charge, inflation tends to rise. That's because political leaders want rates low as a way to buoy business. The business cycle doesn't align with the political cycle, says Aaron Klein, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sometimes the Fed has to enact short-term stressors, such as raising interest rates, to fend off inflation. By doing so, it enhances the chances of a stabler and stronger economy long-term holds. The backlash to the Trump administration's move is beginning to build. On Monday, three former Fed Reserve chairs and four past Treasury secretaries blasted the administration in a statement. The reported criminal inquiry into Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell is an unprecedented attempt to use prosecutorial attacks to undermine the Fed's independence, wrote Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen, and Alan Greenspan, joined by Robert Rubin, Henry Paulson, Timothy Geithner, and Jacob Liu. The threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on their best assessment of what will serve the public, rather than following the preferences of the president, Mr. Powell said in his statement, a video post on the official website of the Fed's Board of Governors. Mr. Trump has said he didn't know anything about the investigation. Still, there are recent examples of the president pushing for prosecutions of his political adversaries, such as former FBI Director James Comey. Two Republican senators have also signaled their opposition to the administration's moves. In a statement Sunday night, retiring Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina also said he would oppose the confirmation of any Fed nominee until the legal matter is fully resolved. On Monday, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska posted on the social platform X, "It's clear the administration's investigation is nothing more than an attempt to coercion. If the Federal Reserve loses its independence, the stability of our markets and the broader economy will suffer." Privately, a growing number of CEOs are also expressing unease about the administration's direction towards a more hands-on economic role for the White House, says Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, founder and president of the Chief Executive Leadership Institute at Yale University. For example, energy industry CEOs are resisting Mr. Trump's plans to use their money to rebuild Venezuela's oil fields. They're already mad about that, he says. The moves against Fed independence have just added another log to the fire. Mr. Powell's decision to publicly counter the president borrows from the playbook of board member Mariner Eccles in 1951, when the central bank struggled with President Harry Truman over its independence. Truman wanted the Fed to continue its wartime agreement to keep interest rates low to finance the war effort, though inflation was raging. Truman met with members of the Fed and then publicly announced they would continue the wartime policy. In fact, no such agreement was made, and Eccles made public his own version of the meeting. Eventually, with the help of Congress, the Fed prevailed, reestablishing its independence in formal accord. These are not the first charges of lying to Congress that the Justice Department has pursued against a Trump political adversary during this term in office. The DOJ filed similar charges against Mr. Comey in September after public pressure from Mr. Trump. "We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility," the president wrote in a social media post days before the Justice Department secured a grand jury indictment against Mr. Comey. The former FBI director pleaded not guilty to the charges, but a judge threw out the case 2 months ago after ruling that the prosecutor who brought it had been unlawfully appointed. The Justice Department is appealing the ruling. Mr. Powell says the Justice Department is investigating allegations that he had lied to Congress about the costs of renovations to Federal Reserve offices in Washington during a June hearing before the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. Responding to reports that the renovation includes ornate features such as special elevators, water features, and a rooftop garden, Mr. Powell said that some of those claims are just flatly misleading. Some of those are no longer in the plans, he added. The plans have continued to evolve. Cost overruns for federal infrastructure projects are typically investigated by Congress alone. When the Department of Justice can get involved as if during that investigation, a potential criminal offense is uncovered. That is what happened here. When, in July, Representative Ana Paulina Luna, a Florida Republican and staunch Trump ally, asked the Justice Department to investigate Mr. Powell for potential perjury and making false statements to officials. Official project documents contradict Mr. Powell's congressional testimony, she claims. Such prosecutions are rare, however. False statement cases can be easy to charge but very difficult to prove, says Paul Butler, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a former federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C. Winning such a case requires that a jury find beyond a reasonable doubt that a defendant lied knowingly and willfully and with an intent to deceive. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, which is handling the investigation, said it does not comment on ongoing investigations. Some Trump officials, meanwhile, say they believe a criminal investigation is warranted. Kevin Hassett, the White House's National Economic Council Director, told reporters Monday morning that if he were Fed chair, he would want DOJ scrutiny of the renovations. Mr. Hassett has been shortlisted to replace Mr. Powell. I think that it's really important to understand where the taxpayer money goes and understand why it goes this way or that, he added. Parallel to the investigation into Mr. Powell is the Trump administration's effort to fire Ms. Cook, a member of the Federal Reserve Board. Members of the Federal Reserve can only be fired for cause, according to federal law. But the Trump administration has been pressing to change that rule for other leadership positions in the executive branch. Given the importance that financial experts place on insulating U.S. monetary policy from political influence, the Fed has emerged as an exception to arguments that the president should have the power to remove board members unilaterally. In an unsigned order in May, the U.S. Supreme Court wrote that the Fed is entitled to for-cause removal protections because it's a uniquely structured quasi-private entity. Next week, the justices may consider that Fed exception in more depth when they hear oral argument in the Cook case. Of more relevance to Mr. Powell, however, is what interest the court may have in the definition of for cause. Ms. Cook is facing allegations of mortgage fraud from the Trump administration, but formal criminal charges have not yet been filed. Ms. Cook's lawyers have called the allegations baseless. But Trump officials could argue that allegations of a crime alone are enough cause to fire her. Thus, an investigation of Powell, even without charges being brought, could be sufficient to fire him for cause, just like how he's trying to fire Lisa Cook, said Professor Butler. Staff writer Victoria Hoffman contributed reporting for this story. And on the topic of United States society, here's a new article, What Do Trump Demands Mean for Smithsonian's Independence? By Caitlin Babcock, staff writer, and Victoria Hoffman, Washington. In a dispute with the Trump administration that threatens to change the museum's historic independence from the executive branch, the Smithsonian Institution faces a January 13th deadline to turn over records about its content to the government or face possible funding cuts. The world's largest museum and research complex, including 21 free museums in Washington that range in focus from American history to art, to air and space, makes its own decisions about its exhibits and how to present historical narratives. About 17 million people visit the museums each year. The deadline signals a potential turning point in President Donald Trump's year-long effort to manage what visitors see at the Smithsonian museums, including during the celebration of America's 250th birthday. The Smithsonian did not immediately comment on whether it would comply with Mr. Trump's demand. He has ordered the end of funding for exhibits that do not divide Americans based on race. An examination of historical displays in national parks, and a focus on the greatness of the achievements and progress of the American people. While many of President Trump's supporters argue that highlighting historic divisions can diminish Americans' sense of national pride, many historians say that grappling with the darker aspects of the American history is important, so negative moves are not repeated. There's always scrutiny around museums and how they tell stories, says Susie Anderson, head of the Museum Studies Program at George Washington University. That's because the work of museums is deeply important in reflecting a people back to itself. But Ms. Anderson says the aggressiveness with which the Trump administration is pursuing its goals is unlike anything the Smithsonian has experienced before. Those with power are always interested in trying to get the official message within the museums to align their visions in what they're trying to achieve, she says. It's one of the reasons museums have developed practices, professional codes of ethics, and why their institutional independence is so important. The Smithsonian is a uniquely structured institution. It's overseen by a board of regents made up of citizens as well as members from the three branches of the U.S. government. Some 63% of the Smithsonian's budget of over $1 billion is funded by congressional appropriations. In March 2025, Mr. Trump signed an executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. He accused the Smithsonian of rewriting history in a way that contributed to a sense of national shame. The president also ordered Vice President J.D. Vance to leverage his position on the Smithsonian's Board of Regents to remove exhibits or programs that, with improper ideology. Examples included exhibitions featuring transgender athletes and those that presented race as a social rather than a biological matter or construct. Then, last August, the Trump administration wrote to the Smithsonian Secretary announcing a comprehensive review of the content in 8 museums ahead of the celebration of America's 250th anniversary. The review sought to ensure museums celebrate American exceptionalism and remove divisive or partisan narratives. A follow-up letter, dated December 18th, accused the Smithsonian of failing to turn over all the requested material and set a January 13th deadline for the rest, noting that much of the Smithsonian funding is federal money controlled by Congress. The National Portrait Gallery, part of the Smithsonian, last week removed a label accompanying Mr. Trump's portrait in the museum's America's Presidents exhibition, which included text that noted that he was impeached twice on charges of abuse of power and incitement of insurrection. It's not clear whether that was connected to the museum complex's dispute with the administration. Since at least 2020, Mr. Trump and conservative commentators have criticized the Smithsonian for incorporating what they call a leftist agenda. A 2020 exhibit at the National Museum for African American History and Culture drew particular ire for listing traits of white dominant culture, including hard work and the nuclear family. Following the backlash, the museum took down the exhibition and issued an apology. Mr. Trump has also accused the museums of overemphasizing dark parts of women's history, like slavery, and downplaying American achievements. The public's response is divided. Overall, 6 in 10 people oppose Mr. Trump's efforts to review the Smithsonian's contents, but almost 70% of Republicans indicate support, according to an August Quinnipiac University poll. David Blight, a Yale history professor who sits at the National Portrait Gallery's Board of Commissioners, says while disagreements often arise about a particular exhibit, outside interference, especially by politicians, is not needed. There are mechanisms within the museum's independent structure, he notes, to have constructive debates and then find solutions. You can have tremendous fights, but that's professionalism of it, he says. Sarah Wixel, the executive director of the American Historical Association and a former historian at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, says complexity is part of the museum experience. A museum is never intended to produce a single definitive story, Ms. Wixel says. It's an entry point for visitors to learn, to question, and to continue to explore once they leave that museum. Museum exhibitions typically undergo a lengthy internal review before being open to the public. Mr. Blight says that process often takes 2 or 3 years and involves collective input from groups of scholars, as well as from experts in audio and visual displays. Throughout history, there have been museum exhibits that sparked public controversy. In the mid-1990s, for example, a planned exhibit in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum featuring a refurbished Enola Gay, the B-29 plane that dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima in World War II, was criticized by many veterans and citizens who said the script presented American soldiers as vengeful. The exhibit was eventually canceled. However, experts say that although the Smithsonian has weathered heated disputes, it's dealt with them independently through intellectual discussion. The difference now, they say, is that a presidential administration is trying to leverage its power to influence what should and should not be displayed. On Monday afternoon, Sean Tess and her husband, Sam Tess, have just finished visiting the National Museum of African American History and Culture. It is the two Alaskans' first time in Washington, and Mr. Trump's plans for the Smithsonian have been on their minds. We've been talking about that since we got here, Ms. Tess says. This visit brings up a lot of emotions for us. Mr. Tess is a naturalized refugee who came to the United States from Cambodia in 1980. He says visiting Washington and seeing museums makes him feel very proud, but he and his wife are unsettled. They say they are concerned that some important parts of history could be edited out. There's a lot at stake, says Ms. Tess. We've come so far. Have you been in there? She asked, gesturing behind her to the African American History Museum. We can't move forward and heal if we don't acknowledge the past. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lanny. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast audio and info. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. And on a topic of Asia and South Central, how the race for rare earths could shape Myanmar's civil war. By Akash Hassan, contributor, January 13, 2026. Myanmar's civil war rages on as the country resumes voting in what critics describe as sham elections designed to legitimize military rule. An estimated 3.5 million people have been displaced since the military overthrew the elected government in a 2021 coup. And across the countryside, rebel groups armed with drones, rocket launchers, and improvised explosives are fighting to hold the line. But analysts say there's more to the story than arms, territory, and questionable elections. The future of this conflict will be shaped by another factor lying just under the surface, rare earth minerals. Myanmar is a globally critical source of heavy rare earth elements, almost all of which flows into China for processing, says Richard Horsey, Myanmar advisor to the International Crisis Group. The deposits lie mostly in rebels' rural strongholds, bringing revenue and political leverage to groups fighting against the military junta. As international competition over these minerals grows, Myanmar's rare earth boom could bring investment that nudges the country towards stability, or it could prolong a war already fueled by the pursuit of power and resources. Used in electric vehicles, wind turbines, advanced electronics, and military systems, rare earth minerals have become central to economic competitiveness and national security around the world. China sits at the heart of the industry. It's the world's largest consumer and importer of rare earth ores and compounds, and dominates their processing into refined materials and magnets, giving Beijing outside influence over global supply chains. In response to U.S. tariffs last year, China tightened controls over rare earth exports, a move that highlighted how dependent the world has become on China's rare earth refining technology. China is consolidating upstream control and restricting downstream exports, while countries like India, Japan, and the U.S. are scrambling to stockpile material and develop alternative refining capacity, says Dr. Horsey. In the near term, however, there is no substitute for China's processing dominance. And Myanmar plays a key role in feeding that dominance. While public data is limited, trade and research estimates suggest that more than half and possibly up to two-thirds of China's rare earth imports by volume have come from Myanmar in recent years. Between 2017 and 2024, Myanmar exported more than 290,000 metric tons of rare earth materials to China, valued at over $4.2 billion. Around 85% of those exports were sent after the 2021 coup. As China, Japan, and the United States explore ways to reduce reliance on China-dominated systems, Myanmar is emerging as a potential, if deeply complicated, source for the raw material. India's interest is particularly keen. New Delhi has reportedly begun engaging with several ethnic armed groups, including the Kachin Independence Organization, KIO, a rebel outfit that controls some of the world's richest supplies of dysprosium and terbium, in Myanmar's northern Kachin state, which shares a border with both China and India. Sources within these groups say Indian officials are considering strengthening cross-border road connectivity to facilitate access to rare earth resources, which could complicate an already fragmented conflict landscape. India's reported entry into rare earth extraction in northern Myanmar introduces a new regional player, says Angasunan Choudhury, a Myanmar-focused researcher. It creates a new competitive fissure in regional geopolitics and gives armed groups like the KIO another partner to negotiate with. China, however, remains a dominant external actor. China would never allow critical resources on its border to be exploited by a rival, says Dr. Hossi, adding that Beijing is unlikely to view India's interest as an immediate threat, given India's limited refining capacity. The KIO may choose to reject India's business too. The importance of these resources to China creates a strategic risk for the KIO if it is regarded as disloyal or non-compliant by Beijing, he says. On whether rising global interest in Myanmar's rare earths could help stabilize the country, many analysts are skeptical. Mr. Chaudhary warns that relying on rare earth revenues like other profits from the extraction of natural resources risks entrenching predatory economies and perpetuating poor governance. Because of the high-stakes nature of rare earths, all armed actors will vie for access and profit, he said, that may incentivize them to fight on rather than pursue peace. And from Europe, we have letter from Moscow. For travelers in Russia, road to Europe is longer than ever, by Fred Weir, special correspondent, Helsinki and Moscow, January 13, 2026. Barely 4 years ago, a visit from Moscow to Helsinki, Finland's stately capital on the Baltic Sea, took just over an hour's flight. Nowadays, to reach Helsinki by air, you begin by flying in the opposite direction, and you'll be on the ground in 10 hours at the earliest, assuming you don't stop for overnight on the way. The old Iron Curtain hasn't slammed down across Russia's border yet, but Western Europe, until recently easily accessible from Moscow, has become extremely hard to reach for most Russians since the war in Ukraine began almost 4 years ago. Air and rail links with all European Union countries were quickly severed when the conflict began. Finland completely closed its border with Russia in late 2023, and the once lively cross-border traffic halted. So when my wife and I decided to make a three-day visit to Helsinki in late December, the itinerary for the round trip envisaged nearly 4 days on the road, involving planes, trains, boats, and cars. And to be clear, it probably wouldn't have been possible at all if either of us were traveling on a Russian passport. Last November, the European Union stopped issuing multiple entry Schengen visas to Russians and clamped down hard on single entry ones. The most common portal for Russians traveling to the West these days is Istanbul. Baku, Azerbaijan, Yerevan, Armenia, and Belgrade. Serbia also provide tenuous air bridges between Moscow and the outside world. For Russians heading to North America, Casablanca in Morocco is a popular gateway. But even getting to Istanbul is a much longer flight than it used to be, because the plane has to detour around the Ukrainian war zone, adding at least an hour to the now almost five-hour trip. The flow of Russian tourists to Europe has reduced considerably. There are no organized tours at all anymore, says Mikhail Maltsev, chair of the Urals Region Association of Tour Operators. It's expensive, it's complicated, it's exhausting. Some people still go to Hungary, where the public attitude towards Russians is welcoming, and visas are more readily obtainable. But Istanbul is a nice place to overnight, with mild weather and good food, before another five-hour flight across the continent to reach Helsinki the next day. The Finnish passport control officer took a long and deep interest in my Canadian passport, with all the Russian stamps on it, and gave me a very quizzical look, but didn't ask for an explanation. As a frequent visitor to Finland over the past four decades, I find the change in attitude towards Russians since the Nordic country joined NATO in 2023 is palpable. Finland was once one of the most Russian-friendly countries in Europe and proud of its neutrality. But polls now show that 3/4 of Finns support NATO membership, and outside of a few border areas that have suffered from the cutoff of trade and tourism, they appear to have largely turned their backs on their huge Slavic neighbor. Our relations with Russia have changed permanently, Finnish President Alexander Stubb noted in his New Year's address, adding that future relations will depend on Russia's actions. One thing I learned on this trip is that, unlike Cold War days, there are a lot of Russians in Europe. After decades of relatively free movement, statistics suggest that more than 1 million Russian-born people reside within the EU, including more than 300,000 passport holders. Finland alone has a Russian minority of more than 100,000, and ahead of the then approaching New Year holiday, quite a few of them were planning to visit friends and family back in Russia. There is an alternative to returning to Moscow by air via Istanbul. It's much closer to Helsinki and a lot cheaper, but it's just as time-consuming and massively inconvenient. It involves getting to one of the handful of crossings that are still open on the tense border between Russia and NATO, located in the Baltic state of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Those can be difficult to reach and involve crushing lineups and strict checks on both sides. There do not appear to be any that are currently open to road traffic, so you must walk across, lugging your baggage, often in foul weather. The Russian daily Izvestia recently ran an article about the conditions at the Estonian crossing point at Narva, describing it as an obstacle course with wait times of up to 20 hours. That is not for the faint of heart. Friends advise us that conditions at the Estonian border crossing of Koidula near Tartu were more bearable. The first step to getting there was to board the Megastar, a giant car and passenger ferry that was something like a floating shopping mall, for a two-hour passage across the Gulf of Finland from Helsinki to Tallinn, the Estonian capital. We spent the night enjoying a very pleasant evening in Tallinn's medieval walled city, which featured a lively Christmas festival in the old town square. We left early the next morning in a hired car for a four-hour drive to Koidula, hoping to make it before the regular daily train from Tallinn disgorged hundreds of people seeking to cross the border. Only a few dozen souls, all speaking Russian, were already there, and at least for us, the Estonian checks were polite and relatively quick. Then it was a walk of about 500 yards across what can only be described as no man's land to the Russian side. But the first point filtered people according to whether they had a Russian passport or not. My wife was one, I do not. After some discussion, I was allowed through on the strength of my permanent Russian residency papers and official foreign journalist accreditation, which, despite recent unpleasantness, is still a fairly strong document in Russia. At the next, much more stringent checkpoint, I managed to avoid being directed to the long line of rather forlorn-looking people waiting to have a conversation with security officers about their reasons for wanting to visit Russia. A long and thorough customs inspection followed, to nothing to declare option here, and then it was out to a waiting car to take us to the nearby Russian city of Pskov. The border crossing took us about 3 hours altogether, which others who've been through it say is amazingly fast. In Pskov, we boarded the overnight train to Moscow. We had splurged for one of the new deluxe compartments, which featured double bunk beds, dinner and breakfast, and an ensuite bathroom with shower for the roughly 500-mile trip. When we rolled into Moscow's Leningrad station the next morning, it was almost exactly a week since we had set out to spend 3 days in Helsinki. Some Russian travel experts say the rift with Europe is primarily permanent, and that travel-loving Russians are compensating by discovering their own vast and varied country, and also by turning to parts of the world where Russians are still welcome. Anton Kortev, a prolific travel blogger, says that air travel to the East has become much easier. China has dropped visa requirements for Russians, and Beijing is now the main hub for Russians traveling to Asia and beyond. I myself recently visited New Zealand via China and encountered many of the problems that beset travel to Europe, he says. But Mr. Maltsev says nothing will replace Europe as a coveted destination for Russians. We feel that the interest has been postponed until better times, he says. But once all these restrictions are eased, there will be a lot of pent-up demand to return to popular European places. And on the economy, 2026 could be a defining year for AI, from shopping to electricity. By Caitlin Babcock, staff writer, January 13, 2026, Washington. In 2025, a record $61 billion flowed into the market for data centers that power artificial intelligence. Waymo expanded its driverless taxi service to 5 cities. AI-fueled scientific breakthroughs in areas from weather forecasting to healthcare. AI experts predict even greater impacts this year. The number of data centers is expected to grow, fueling more applications that will increasingly play roles in most people's daily lives. That could lead to higher electricity prices and spur conversations about whether the technology is changing society for the better. I think 2026 will be defining. In a sense, AI is no longer just something exciting, but we have to grapple with how it's affecting our daily life and energy demands, says Anjana Susala, a researcher at Michigan State University. Here's a look at what experts say are major ways AI could change people's daily lives this year. An AI agent is a machine learning model that can pursue a goal and complete tasks in place of a person. It can make decisions on its own and adapt based on the goal it's been given. For example, you could use an AI tool to monitor prices and book a flight on your behalf according to parameters you assigned it. These tools started to come into play in 2025, as companies began to unveil agentic browsers, which allow AI to interact with websites on behalf of someone. In July, retail chain Walmart rolled out 4 AI agents, one of which helps customers find items in the company's app. On the music platform Spotify, users can opt to use AI to create personalized playlists. We're not talking about OpenAI building some cutting-edge AI tool, says Ms. Sursala. We're talking about retailers that all of us are familiar with. As these models become more advanced and less prone to making mistakes, experts predict they could become an essential part of more and more businesses, changing companies' workflows and consumers' experiences. In a 2025 survey by McKinsey & Company, 62% of respondents said their organizations were already at least experimenting with AI agents. Martin Hilbert, a professor at the University of California, Davis, who researches questions of AI and ethics, predicts workplaces in particular could experience restructuring as they adopt agentic AI. For one thing, AI agents could free up workers' time by taking over everyday tasks, such as checking emails. AI can automate many of these really repetitive, boring tasks that fill the daily schedule of many workers, he says. Dr. Hilbert also mentions that a proliferation of AI use in the workplace could mean that those who master this technology get a serious leg up among their coworkers, or even push them out. Some people who use AI effectively can replace their tasks from other people that don't, he says. We can expect a reorganization happening among professionals. Data centers that produce the computing power to run AI can use as much electricity as a small city. They're multiplying rapidly. The number in the U.S. roughly doubled between 2021 and 2024. The International Energy Agency, an intergovernmental organization that works to secure sustainable energy, estimates around 4% of the electricity consumed nationally in 2024 was used by data centers. This growth has spurred rising energy costs across the country, particularly in areas such as Maryland and Ohio, where data centers are highly concentrated. One study from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh estimates data centers and cryptocurrency mining could cause an 8% increase in the average U.S. electricity bill by 2030. The high demand, the study found, forces some energy generators in certain markets to buy electricity from more expensive sources, including coal-fired plants. The spread of these data centers has started to attract bipartisan attention from elected officials. Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, recently called for a moratorium on all new AI centers, citing concerns about AI taking people's jobs. Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis unveiled an AI Bill of Rights last month that would protect communities' rights to push back against new data centers' construction. Energy impacts of AI are coming front and center, says Ms. Sosola. Google recently unveiled plans to try to build new AI data centers in outer space in order to help mitigate the cost of energy because the centers could run on solar power. That idea is gaining traction among leaders of AI companies, but in the short term, these costs are expected to mount as large tech companies invest hundreds of billions of dollars in the construction of new data centers on Earth. Experts predict the growth of a phenomenon that's become known as AI slop, low-quality AI-generated content aimed at getting attention. This can include AI-generated videos, photos, songs, or articles that some people might assume are real. A Guardian analysis from last summer found that 1 in 10 of the fastest-growing YouTube channels globally shows only AI-generated content. The content is so prevalent, it has spurred concerns that people will have a harder time determining what is produced by a human and what is not, and whether what they're seeing is real. If you go on any social media content, a lot of what you're going to see is AI, says Ir Iskatovits, director of the Applied Ethics Center at University of Massachusetts, Boston. He predicts the blended content could lead to a breakdown of trust and information. Another concern is that this artificial content will crowd out real artists, writers, and content creators who are trying to make money. The issue is further complicated by an executive order from the Trump administration seeking to block state laws regarding AI, an order Mr. Isaacovitz calls a shipwreck for AI regulation. The order is expected to be challenged in courts in the coming year. Ms. Sosala says the trend could lead to more conversations about how original content is valued and whether social media should have more guardrails defining who can publish what kinds of content. With all this proliferation, are we losing something, she asks? What happens to consumer trust and safety? And here's the monitor's view for Greenland Partnership Over Publicity by the monitor's editorial board. In the midst of the Arctic winter, residents of Greenland are feeling the heat of global geopolitics. United States officials have stepped up insistence on the need to take control of the most ice-covered island by force or by financial means. The declarations stress Greenland's strategic location along Arctic sea routes, which both Russia and China are vying to use, as well as access to its estimated 1.5 million tons of rare earth mineral reserves. What's at stake is not just about rare earths. It's about the very idea of sovereignty in an age of resource rivalry. Fa Kim Beng of the Institute of International and ASEAN Studies wrote in the Malay Mail, "The U.S. logic is rooted in energy security, future-proofing supply chains, especially minerals, and in the strategic denial of competitors." Geopolitics analyst and best-selling author Tim Marshall wrote in the Times of London, "In this view, the Danish territory is an asset to be owned rather than an ally with which to engage, an approach that runs counter to 80 years of global treaties and norms that have prioritized diplomacy over bellicosity. With China's current predominance in the extraction and processing of rare earth minerals, essential for the automotive, military, and tech industries, the U.S. is playing catch-up, and both countries are applying aspects of centuries-old mercantilism which took a zero-sum view of resources as limited, plus requiring economic domination of other nations. An Australian think tank has identified a related notion of frontierism, which sees Earth's polar regions as areas to be conquered, developed, or claimed, rather than shared as global commons. This trend prompted a conference last year in Nuuk, Greenland's capital, to call for expanding polar law to address extraction and fair use of resources as melting ice caps affect fish stocks and access to land-based resources. Examples of multilateral approaches to such global commons are somewhat uncommon, but still instructive. A 2023 security pact among the U.S., South Korea, and Japan included cooperation on critical mineral supply chain issues. Other examples include a 2001 United Nations Fish Stocks Agreement and the 2008 Great Lakes Agreement and Compact between the U.S. and Canada, and multiple water-sharing agreements in Central Asia. In an era of intense tech competition, perhaps the greatest rare earth of all is trust among nations. As Malaysian analyst Dr. Fard observed, if that melts away like Arctic ice, the world that emerges will be far more brittle than the minerals buried between the Greenland's frozen soil. And that's all the time we have for today's reading.